Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the big story in the news, and that is the economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C. We'll begin with an analysis of dueling speeches at the 11th hour, the president's and John Boehner's, that were afforded equal time in the press, even though only one side is threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of what they want. Jonathan Cohn, the senior editor at The New Republic, joins us to discuss who is really responsible for the deficit and the debt. Then we will talk to a presidential historian who studies both the American right and the presidency, Alan Lichtman, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement. He joins us to assess the role of the Tea Party in preventing compromise as the American ship of state heads for the abyss. Then, in light of criticism from James Carville and others who faced a similar situation during the Clinton administration when Newt Gingrich threatened to shut down the government, which he did, we will talk strategy, which according to many is sorely lacking in the Obama White House. Carl Agnew, a campaign strategist, joins us to explain whether Obama's latest speech is too little too late and what moves might be left for him before the economy is destroyed and his election chances end up as collateral damage. Joining us now is Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior editor at The New Republic and a senior fellow at Demos. Previously, he was the executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohn.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What was your impression of the president's address to the nation, followed by John Boehner's address? My feeling about it, frankly, Jonathan, is I've never seen it before. The press in this country were kind of billing them as with equal time.
Yeah, it's unusual. We've gotten into the habit of, it's custom now when there's a major address to Congress, for example. The president gives the State of the Union, then there's a response from the Republican or Democratic opposition, depending on who's in the White House. I don't recall them doing this for this was a much smaller scale speech. It was impromptu, and this is a new development, I think. I'm not 100% sure about that. I don't really mind it, by the way. I'm always, I'm a journalist, so more speech is better, and, let's air out both sides. But it did seem like something new.
The president is the president, and he's able to do this. He has that prerogative. But let's talk about then the speeches themselves. We're not going to review them, but I'd like to get your impression of who made the stronger case.
Well, it's funny. I always sort of try to remind myself when I'm watching a speech like this one that, 99% of the country has a life, and that life does not, that does not involve following politics for a living. So as a professional watching these speeches, I'm hearing things often for the 10th, the 100th time, and so I always try to put myself in the mind of someone who really hasn't followed this debate but is really hearing it for the first time. They've heard some rumbling. There's some fight about debt level and deficit. What's this all about? Oh, okay, the president is going to speak. The leader of the Republican Party is going to speak. What did I hear? I thought they actually got a fairly accurate portrayal in some ways of the two positions, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the president has agreed that as part of this agreement to raise the debt ceiling, which is something we need to do. Remember, this is not about spending new money. It's about paying the bills that we ran up before. That as part of this agreement to raise that debt ceiling, he's willing to make an agreement with the Republican Party on how to reduce deficits in the long run. And in so doing, he's willing to meet them. He's described himself meeting them halfway, a little more than halfway. I would say he's gone well beyond meeting them halfway. I think most people who watch this from have noticed, and not just liberals, but even conservatives, said, gee, the deals to which he has agreed to, and which, frankly, a good number of Republicans in the Senate have agreed to, involve giving up a lot more from the Democratic side than they do from the Republican side. And by that we mean, there's been agreements to reduce a lot of spending, not just on what we call discretionary programs, student loans, funding for the FAA, things like that, but, mandatory entitlement spending, passing some cuts to Medicaid and Medicare, things that I really am not very happy about. And the Republicans, in return, have not given a lot, despite, I think, fair evidence that, we could return tax rates to what they were during the Clinton era. The Republicans have said no to any revenue at all in the deal. And he's made clear that he's tried to compromise, but the problem is these House Republicans who won't compromise. And then we had the leader of the House Republicans, Speaker Boehner, get up there and say, we're not going to compromise, basically saying the same thing, that we have a hard line on this. We will not agree to this if we have to put serious new revenue on the table, and that's it. And I think it's, Well, that's pretty much, you understand those two facts, that we have one side that's willing to compromise, one side that is making a very hard stand on this principle of no revenue, and you have a pretty good understanding of why we're in this situation now.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, I know we live in an era, the post-Karl Rove era, where the truth is a moving target, and he who manages and manipulates the truth the most effectively wins the argument. And there's no consensus anymore in this country about what is true. To that extent, I think we're disadvantaged. But it would seem to me that the one thing that might resonate, and I think there's a lot of polling to suggest that, is that the president made it real clear that the Republicans are absolutely fighting to the last man to protect the prerogatives of the millionaires and the billionaires. And he made that point over and over again. Boehner looked to me like he was angry and didn't want to have to even bring that subject up, because I think to some extent the president is shaming them, indicating how faithful they are to their billionaire backers. And it would seem to me that that might resonate. And I know the Republicans have come up with this wonderful piece of mental gymnastic now to refer to millionaires and billionaires as job creators. But I don't think that's washing.
No, I don't think it is either. And when you think about the politics of this, and you know, who knows? I always sort of give a disclaimer. I feel very comfortable saying for sure what I think about policy. Politics, you know, who knows? It's changing. People see things differently. But the polls certainly indicate that if you ask people in this country, right, if you go out and say, look, we have these deficits, we need to close them. How should we close them? And most Americans, they want a mix of things. And as part of that mix, they think, yeah, let's ask the very wealthiest members of this country to pay a little more in taxes than they do now, particularly given the fact that they've done so well, particularly recently, and that ever since 2001, when President Bush came into office, their taxes have gone down. And most Americans like this. Again, when we go back to the deals that were offered, all that, you know, the deals that President Obama offered recently, the only thing he was asking was, look, let's get some revenue back from the wealthiest Americans. And this the Republicans will not do. I mean, they have indicated clearly over and over again this is a bright red line for them. They do not want those tax rates to go up on. They think it's wrong. Now, they call it job killers, and some of them do argue that, well, if you raise taxes on the very wealthiest people in this country, you know, that's not going to work. It's going to kill jobs because these are the wealth creators. You know, the two things to remember when you hear that are, number one, nobody is talking about raising taxes in the next year or year and a half. I mean, we are in a very precarious economic situation right now. We don't have enough jobs. Frankly, I think that's what we should be spending all our time talking about and putting, not really worrying so much about the deficit right now. We do have this jobs problem, and because of that, everybody seriously who's talking about either cutting government spending or raising taxes, both of which would slow economic growth, they talk about doing it starting in a year or two once the economy is on surer footing. So that's the first thing. No one's talking about raising taxes tomorrow. But the second thing to remember is that, you know, we have experience with higher tax rates on the wealthy, and it's called the 1990s. And guess what? The economy grew pretty well back then. And in fact, there's a lot of literature on this. I mean, there is a point at which you can raise taxes enough that you could really start to kill jobs. But we are pretty far away from that right now. You know, compared to other countries, we have a ridiculously low tax burden in this country. We can afford to raise taxes on the wealthiest members of our society without harming the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's the senior editor at The New Republic. Just in terms, though, of this environment where the truth is a moving target, you've published this graph that I think came from the New York Times, and it was based on figures from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And it really makes it clear. It's called the Bush deficit. It just shows you there in black and white and red the difference between what Obama has run up in terms of debt and what his predecessor, George W. Bush, ran up in terms of debt. And my understanding, just in broad strokes, is that George W. Bush has actually run up over a third of the entire national debt since the beginning of the Republic. And if you combine him with his father and Ronald Reagan, that accounts for over half of the entire debt since the beginning of the Republic.
Well, I don't know about those precise figures, but certainly it is the case that when you think about the deficits we have right now, and you think about whose responsibility are they, again, if you listen to the commentary out there, if you listen to the Republican Party, if you listen to the conservative commenters, they'll say, President Obama has run up the deficit. But that's not really true. To the extent that the policies of the Obama administration have contributed to the deficit, it is largely because of very temporary spending measures enacted during the economic slowdown, for good reason. You know, when the economy is slow, we want deficit spending. That's how we boost demand. I mean, this is economics 101. Anyone who sort of believes in sort of the basic mainstream principles of economics would agree to that, conservatives too. The real drivers of the debt right now turn out to be the fact that, well, gosh, what happened during the Bush years? First thing they did, they cut taxes substantially. And then, you know, they had two wars that they didn't bother to pay for, and they enacted a drug benefit for Medicare that they didn't pay for. And again, the contrast here is, I think, quite stunning, whether you want to go back in time or forward in time. And by that, I mean, let's look at what the Bush administration did on its Medicare drug benefit, and let's compare that approach to what President Obama did with health care reform. You know, one of the reasons that health care reform fight took so long and was so painful was that President Obama and his allies in the Democratic Congress were determined to pass a health care bill that actually paid for itself. That's very hard to do. You had to raise some they had to levy some taxes to go with it. You had to cut some spending to go with it, and they did it. Unlike the Bush administration, which said, oh, we're just going to, you know, have this new benefit and we're not going to bother to pay for it. That contributed to deficits. If you go back in time, remember again, during the 1990s, President Clinton, and before him, by the way, the first President Bush, who was a lot more responsible about these things, they signed off on budgets that actually reduced deficits by a combination of higher taxes and lower spendings. And lo and behold, we got to the end of the 1990s, and because of those changes and because of a strong economy, not only had we eliminated the deficit, people forget now, but the government was running surpluses. And, you know, in the 2000 presidential debate, there was a big debate about what to do with these surpluses. And the Democrat who was running for president, Al Gore, said, well, let's put those aside for a rainy day, because you know what? We have surpluses now, but we won't in the future. And George Bush said, no, we can't have surpluses. The government will just spend the money. We need to give that all back as tax cuts. Well, those tax cuts created a huge budgetary hole that are a big reason for our deficits right now. Frankly, if we got rid of all the Bush tax cuts, and to be fair, we'd have to get rid of the ones that benefit lower incomes as well, we'd really take care of the deficit problem, at least for the next few years. There's a long-term problem that would require other changes, but don't for a second believe anybody who tells you that these are Obama's deficits right now. They're not. They're Bush's deficits.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior editor at The New Republic. And I think, though, when you mentioned George H.W. Bush, W.'s father, how he was responsible, I think he was more than responsible. He was actually quite courageous in that he did what leaders are supposed to do and what Obama's actually been calling upon the Republicans to show some signs of leadership. He violated his no new tax pledge, and that cost him dearly politically, but he did the right thing.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it's a reminder of the kind of leadership to which we were once accustomed, right, in this country from both parties. And you know, and there was a time when you had plenty of people in the Republican Party who thought like he did. It was controversial at the time, but it was not crazy that a Republican would say, gee, we might have to raise taxes. After all, Ronald Reagan himself raised taxes during his administration. It was understood that if you're going to be a responsible leader, if you're going to be a reasonable steward of the public trust, that sometimes you're going to have to compromise, and sometimes you're going to have to do things that maybe you don't want to do, but they're necessary, in this case, to keep the finances of the U.S. government on a sound footing.
Well, Reagan did raise a rather regressive tax, which was the payroll tax, which in effect punishes people for having jobs.
Exaggerate the virtues of Ronald Reagan,
right,
here.
I'm saying just compared to Bush's tax cuts, which disproportionately went to the wealthy. So let's just deal with in the last few minutes then, Jonathan Cohn. Again, I know you're comfortable with the economics, not the politics, but let's talk strategy then, because James Carville, who was a strategist for Clinton, and I think Clinton played things much better than it appears that Obama's playing things in terms of his face-off with Newt Gingrich when a similar situation happened. In this case, of course, the government was shut down. Now the stakes are much, much greater. You have an economic hostage crisis brought on by the Republicans for the first time in the history of the debt ceiling, and they are really threatening to bring the house down. And, of course, the problem that Obama has in calling their bluff is that he's going to be stuck with a devastated economy, which, by the way, is exactly what Donald Trump just said, rather with a glee on Fox News with Fox and Friends, saying, well, they'll forget about it in a year's time and the place will be such a mess that it'll all be on Obama's plate and it'll destroy his presidency. So Carville is saying that so far it's been a Republican rout, that this White House has been completely wrong-footed from day one. And a lot of the criticism is that the speech that Obama just made, he should have made it weeks ago.
Yeah, no, actually it was funny. Last night after the speech, I got emails from two different senior staff in Congress. And almost word for word, they said the same thing, which was great speech, would have been perfect a month ago. And I as reluctant as I generally am to second-guess people on strategy, because I tend to think I don't know all the moving pieces and I'm not really good at multidimensional chess, it really does seem like Obama has not handled this well. I mean, he's given concession after concession after concession, and, you know, we're no closer at this point to actually having a deal in place. That said, I don't know how this all plays out. I don't know who blames whom. I mean, if you look at the polls, the one thing that does seem to work to the administration's advantage is that people do trust the president a lot more on this than they do the Republicans. And I think a big part of their strategy is to portray Obama genuinely as he is, as a sort of responsible adult who's going to try to do what he thinks is right for the country. And I think that's what he's doing. I don't necessarily agree with him, but I do think that's his strategy. Now, the problem, as you mentioned, is that at the end of the day, if the Republicans end up maneuvering us into a place where they destroy the economy, you know, they may take the initial blame for this agreement blowing up, but Obama's the one running for re-election and needs a good economy to help him. And it's very dangerous. It's really difficult to know how this turns out and how this turns out. Well, although, I'll be honest, I think we're about to see a strange dance happen on Capitol Hill, and we'll see what happens. I don't think anybody exactly knows what's going to happen. It's unusual to have this kind of uncertainty.
It would seem, though, just in terms of tactics, that the president has boxed himself into these pretty difficult choices. You just pointed out that he's reaching out to the center and coming across as the sober adult in the room. And that's clearly what he's been positioning himself to be. But if he does compromise, which I think is fairly likely, he's going to really alienate the already peeved progressive base of the party. So to your mind, is it you're better off winning over the center and losing the left?
Well, I think he's better off not losing either one. And I'm not sure, you know, and he has to figure out a way to do that. Honestly, I don't think he can afford to lose either. I mean, there's not a lot of margin for error at this point. He loses his base. He needs that turnout for the reelection. He loses the center. He loses the swing votes. It may be possible to pull this off. You know, we haven't seen the final chapter yet, and it will be interesting to see what happens if, as I think I expect and a lot of other people expect, Speaker Boehner's plan doesn't pass the House. That will create an interesting dynamic. It's, you know, there's an ending here that works reasonably well for the president and the Democrats. Whether it happens or not very much remains to be seen.
I thank you for joining us here today, Jonathan Cohn.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior editor at The New Republic and a senior fellow at Demos. Previously, he was the executive editor of The American Prospect and is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and The People Who Pay the Price. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a historian about the Tea Party and presidents.
What a ceiling! Mercantiling! Nelson's every risk to the U.S. fisc, we learn. After trillions, are there zillions? Since we make no goods, could a Bretton Woods return? What a ceiling when you're dealing with recapping banks who are clapping. Thanks, that's nice. Spike the panic like the Titanic. Once you've struck the ice, you are stuck to pay the price.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And of course, just in terms of predicting the next president, the problem that Obama has with calling the bluff of the Republicans who are threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States unless they get 100% of their way, would be that the president would be left with the detritus. And as Donald Trump just said on Fox News with Fox and Friends, rather gleefully said that, well, you know, the Republicans will get blamed in the short while if the economy crashes. But in a year or so's time, when Obama's running for president, he's going to take responsibility for it, and he's going to get creamed. So I don't want to put you on the spot with your predictions, but what's your sense of...
Let me say a couple of things about that, Ian. First of all, can you imagine anything more cynical, more treacherous, and dare I say more un-American for conservative Republicans who claim to be patriotic, than to let our economy crash, to let tens of millions of people suffer, perhaps grievously, in order to advance their political objective of defeating Barack Obama in 2012. It's hard to imagine anything more reprehensible than that. Secondly, they're only half right. It is true that ultimately, as Herbert Hoover, someone who should know, said, the president gets the credit for the rain and the blame for the rain and the credit for the sunshine. But that's only one of the 13 factors, the state of the economy going into the election. There are, you know, many other factors, including whether the Republicans have a charismatic candidate, Obama's own charismatic personality, the killing of Osama bin Laden, the lack of a scandal that would, nonetheless, despite the Republicans' efforts to destroy our stability in America, undermine our society, Barack Obama is going to win in 2012. So they might as well get off this awful kick.
Well, the thing that I find extraordinary, Alan Lichtman, is that, and it's perhaps the sort of reductio absurdum of this binary system we have in the press, where you have everything is equal and opposite, leading to the absurdity that if you interview a Holocaust survivor, you are therefore obliged to interview a Holocaust denier. And I see that in the way that Boehner got equal time with the president, and that's the way they're treating it now. And yet one side is willing and threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of their way. The other guy's not doing that, but yet they're equal in the debate. And that I just think that the country's lost its mind in terms of proportionality here.
Yeah, I mean, the press does have some responsibility, not simply to let anyone flap their lips on the air, but to exercise something of a gatekeeper role here. After all, you know, one responsibility of the press is to tell us who's telling the truth, who's fooling us, what's good for the country, and what isn't. And the truth is, of course, that the great majority of the American people are not behind Boehner. They're behind the president's position. Two-thirds say, like the president, they want a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. Every authority in the field says you need to do both, and yet we're holding the country hostage to a few ideologues in the House. It's extraordinary, and they're getting all this credit. I laid it all out in my book that you referred to, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, in which I said Republican conservatives, rather, have nothing to do with fiscal responsibility. They have nothing to do with free markets. They have nothing to do with individualism. What it's all about when it comes to economics is protecting private enterprise, particularly from labor and government regulation and taxation. And that's exactly what's going on here. They're holding the country hostage in order to keep in line tax breaks, benefits, for the wealthiest corporations in America, for the upper 2% of our population who don't need it, at a time, get this, when the distribution of income in America has gotten so unequal that we now have a distribution that's the same as it was on the eve of the Great Depression of 1929. And history teaches us no society can remain viable and stable and democratic under those circumstances. And just today, a new report came out from the Pew Center that this has tremendous racial and ethnic implications. That not only has the gap, not between the rich and the poor anymore, but between the rich and the rest of us grown enormously, so too has the racial gap, so that whites today have 20 times the wealth of African Americans and nearly that of Latinos. This is not a healthy situation, and those phonies in the Tea Party are trying to perpetuate and extend this.
Again, I'm speaking with American University historian Alan Lichtman, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement. But in a couple of ironies here, Alan Lichtman, one is that the Tea Party looked like they're going to scuttle Boehner's bill, that Obama won't even have to veto it because the Tea Party caucus have found some minor flaw in this otherwise totally inflexible wish list that they put forth. But what is so clear about the Tea Party, and I'm again, I fault the press for falling for this idea that somehow this was a grassroots populist movement, or albeit a right-wing populist movement. It is so evident that the Tea Party is entirely AstroTurf, they're entirely faithful whores to the billionaires. They are absolutely the most faithful billionaire backers in the entire United States Congress, so much so that people like the Koch brothers have got them. They're chiefs of staff. There's a study recently showing that the staffers that the Tea Party have taken on are former lobbyists. You know, they've done a study called "From Hired Guns to Hired Hands." So this is the Tea Party. They're 100% captives of big business and big business lobbyists.
And that's what their policies are designed to do, to make those folks richer. And again, it's no longer at the expense of the poor. It's at the expense of everyone.
Take away the history. You're a historian. Doesn't it offend you? I mean, they're trying to pretend that they're somehow the descendants of the Boston Tea Party. I mean,
it totally.
Let's get real here. You know.
Yeah, because as I said, this started in the 70s when business the conservative movement goes back much farther. But the big money flowing into so-called grassroots movements began in the 1970s when the big corporations and the wealthy realized they could buy out these folks, and that they could hide behind this phony veneer of free enterprise, rugged individualism, individual freedom, which has nothing to do what they're really all about. And over the past 30 years, since the modern conservative revolution, the top 5% has seen their incomes almost triple, while the rest of us have barely increased by 1% a year. And that's the truth behind the modern conservative movement, private enterprise. And then the other side, of course, is controlling our personal behavior, and particularly controlling women. What does that have to do with individual freedom and liberty?
Well, it's again the mythology. I mean, to some extent, I fault the president for not seizing on the popular outrage against what happened on Wall Street, because that after all was what galvanized the Tea Party into existence. Of course, it turns out it's been a massive hoax, that they're actually on the side of the billionaires and the hedge fund people who brought about the Wall Street catastrophe in the first place. But
that's exactly right. And, I do fault the president for not being enough out front on this in terms of controlling those who time and again, how many times do they have to fool us? Time and again have enriched themselves at the expense of everybody else, and they don't care because they know they're never going to be held accountable. And, where is the president on the really big issues of our time, like the distribution of income, like the challenge of catastrophic climate change, our environment, our air, our river, our oceans, our very survival on the planet is at stake. And, the Tea Party is lock, stock, and barrel against that, of course, but the president really has not led on those issues, and that's very much tied to the economy. The old smokestack industries are not coming back. We need a new technological revolution that moves us off the fossil fuel economy and moves us into a new economy based on clean, renewable sources of energy. And we've been diddling on that, doing nothing now, for 12 years. It's a real crime, and it's not going to happen unless grassroots individuals and grassroots organizations really push the political class on the environment and on global climate change. You know, here are these huge issues, and we're not even speaking about them.
Again, I'm speaking with historian Alan Lichtman at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. Although, to the president's credit, now a lot of people saying the speech that he just gave was far too late. It should have been, he should have laid down the marker earlier and built a grassroots upswell. Apparently, the phones at the Capitol were jammed and the circuits were overloaded.
That's
because
right.
There was a response. But had this happened earlier, perhaps. But the point I wanted to make was, in the president's defense, was that he laid out a lot of what clearly bothers me and I think bothers you, and that is the unfairness of the idea that the people who have benefited most in the last few decades are being protected at the expense of bringing the entire economy down, just so that billionaires don't have to pay any more taxes when they're getting such a free ride at the moment. And he was pretty clear about it, Obama. And
about time.
and he also pointed out that hedge fund managers pay a less percentage of tax than their secretaries do. So do you think that the American people have a sense of fairness anymore?
I think they do. I think that, you know, the fact that two-thirds of the American people want tax increases as part of any compromise package shows that there is at least a rudimentary sense of fairness out there among the American people. But, you know, it's not as if that sense has been nurtured and developed and moved by our political leadership in order to build a grassroots movement. You know, there has been very little grassroots activity on the left. You saw it during the campaign, but unfortunately, by not taking forward positions on a lot of issues, by expanding the war in Afghanistan, Barack Obama in many ways lost the enthusiasm of his base and lost the enthusiasm of American grassroots politics. Sometimes I fear, Ian, that the only way we're going to really recognize our huge problems, like our waterways, our oceans, our environment, global change, the need for a new fossil fuel-free economy, is if there's some enormous catastrophe in this country. It took the Great Depression to all those, you know, many decades of American history to bring a modicum of social justice, and I fear it may take a crisis of that dimension to bring it about again.
Well, but the organization seems to be on the side of those who are I want to take down what little social safety net that was developed after this catastrophe with the Great Depression. And the legacy of FDR has been on the table, for God's sake, in these negotiations.
Yeah,
that's,
you know,
what we hear. I mean, the worst thing that could happen to many people's mind is that the Republicans would suddenly gain some sanity and accept Obama's deal.
I hear you. This sounds a bit old-fashioned, but we need another New Deal. People don't understand the New Deal. The New Deal was not a big spending program. At the height of the New Deal, the federal budget, get this, was under $10 billion. Even, you know, accounting for enormous increases in inflation, that's a tiny federal budget. What the New Deal really did was enormously increase the opportunities for Americans, their security, and few people realize this, enormously increased the productivity of the American economy through a transformation of our infrastructure. In those days, it was things like bridges and roads and airports. That's what we need today. It's no longer bridges and roads and airports. It's public transit. It is solar energy. It is geothermal energy. It is wind energy. We need a New Deal for that new kind of infrastructure. Or even if you want to talk about a Republican president, we need the model of Dwight Eisenhower and the building of the interstate highway. We need that modernized for the 21st century. And that requires a sense of the common good, and that's going to be hard to get at.
Well, Just in the last couple of minutes, Alan Lichtman, what is your sense then of the dilemma that I think Obama's put himself in, where he's clearly trying to reach out to the center and to look like the real adult, but if any of these concessions he makes become a part of a compromise on Social Security and Medicare, he's going to already disappointed progressives and on the left are going to be even more alienated.
Well, that's right, but I don't think that's going to happen. You know what I think is going to happen? And I could well be wrong on this, but I'll put on my predictor cap. I think Obama may have to exercise his constitutional powers and increase the debt limit on his own and say, to hell with you right-wing Republicans who want to scuttle programs that have lifted scores of millions of people out of poverty, that establish basic security for Americans to protect the few. I'm not going there. And I am going to constitutionally lift the debt ceiling myself under, you know, powers that I have in the Constitution. And, you know,
that's the 14th Amendment you're talking about. You're talking about Section 4 of the 14th Amendment.
Absolutely.
So that
I think he has the authority. There was a piece on this in the New York Times, you know, which is not exactly a left-wing rag, you know. So even mainstream opinion is being moved to that. I think that's far better than acceding to these horrendous cuts that the Republicans want, with absolutely no sacrifice from those who benefited so much over the last 30 years, and, you know, really need to function for the common good again. Right. You know, these Tea Party folks claim to be the heirs of the founding fathers in the tradition of the Boston Tea Party, and yet what they are doing is so fundamentally un-American. You know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, the champion of ordinary people, has to be turning over in his grave.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alan Lichtman.
Anytime, Ian. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's professor of history at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking to a political strategist about the Obama strategy. When it's up to you to figure what's right and wrong, it's someone else's parade, and yours is an unhappy song. Well, don't worry, baby, what the world may bring. Well, don't worry, baby, it won't change a thing. Life is a fight, and then you die. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carl Agnew, who is a founding partner with Gerstein Agnew. He has conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns, including directing national research and message developments for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped found in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Shrum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Agnew.
Thank you very much.
And I guess he's your colleague, James Carville, has been quite critical of this after these speeches of both the president and Boehner on CNN. He felt that for some time now, he called it a rout, that the president's been smoked by the Republicans. Are you that pessimistic about things? I take it, like me, you don't want to see this presidency fail.
Certainly don't want to see it fail, and I think I'm not quite as negative as James, but I think the whole conversation, the whole tenor of this debate, you know, is so lopsided and so one-sided, and I think in a way that ignores what got us to this point. that ignores the spending decisions and the tax decisions that were made that brought us to the deficit situation that we're in now, and that the solutions that are being discussed don't really reflect the problems that got us here in the first place. So I think there's a lot of frustration there, not just myself and James, but progressives across the board.
But doesn't that, to some extent, point the finger at the press? Because first of all, the press gave equal time to both the president and Boehner last night, and that's the way it's been discussed. But it's not an equal argument. One side is threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of their way. I mean, the other, it's an outrageous imbalance.
There was a really striking piece in the Washington Post today talking to House Republicans about where we go from here. And it's really striking that they don't really see that there's a choice. It's just their entire worldview. There's our way, which is the right way, and there is no other choice. So we passed our bill. We passed our completely delusional balanced budget amendment, which has no particulars and has no reality and no chance of ever being signed into law. We passed it, and now we're just going to sit here and watch everything fall apart. There's no interest in negotiating. There's no conception that there might be another way or a give and take. It's not even in their worldview. It's really striking.
So do you think the president should have, as apparently many critics on the Democratic side who are frustrated with the situation and obviously quite alarmed at it, and I think we all should be because it seems to be somewhat out of control. The ship of state seems to be heading for the abyss here. Do you think he should have come out with the speech weeks ago or perhaps a month ago and generated the kind of calls that they got that almost crashed the phone service in the Capitol?
Yeah. In terms of the timing, I'm not sure. I mean, I know the president's tried to negotiate. There have been fits and starts, and I think that in a lot of ways he's frustrated with what he's dealing with because it's such a slippery target. I'm certain that if the president had gone to the House Republicans, and not saying that he ever would have, but just hypothetically, if he had gone to them 2 months ago and said, yes, we agree to all of your demands, every single stipulation you put forth, we agree to it, they would have just moved the goalposts further. There is no fixed target that you're negotiating with. And so I think this president's instincts are always to be the conciliator, to be, as the press keeps saying, the adult in the room, and to try to reach some kind of a middle point. And I think he's just been frustrated not having a partner to conduct those negotiations with.
Well, I hope that's a winning strategy. I'm aware of the expression in this country that nice guys finish last. So tell me, as a political strategist, Carl Agnew, is winning the center mutually exclusive with losing the left?
I don't believe so. The left, the center, in all the public polls, and it's really striking how consistent the polls have been, no matter how you ask the questions. Often you see conservative slanted organizations ask questions one way to produce one result. More progressive organizations ask them in another way, produce another result. Every poll across the board shows that the overwhelming majority of Americans want to see a combination of spending cuts and tax increases, closing loopholes, common sense decisions that bring us to a middle point. They want to see both sides give on this, and it's not even a question what they want. And so there is political pressure to be exerted on Republicans, but they've played this game, and it's been allowed to progress to this late point where now, as you said, the full faith and credit of the United States is in the balance, but there is tremendous political pressure to be paid and a political price to be paid by those who are pushing us to that point. And the polls also suggest that people hold Republicans in Congress much more responsible for this and see them as much less willing to compromise. So there is a political price for them to be paid, and I do think that they will buckle when Social Security checks are not being cut, when veterans are not being paid, when federal prisons are letting prisoners out the doors. I mean, those are the kind of consequences that we're talking about post-August 2nd. When those things start happening, I think a lot of the Republicans who are ignoring the reality of what the post-August 2nd period looks like will quickly discover a new religion.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Agnew, who's a founding partner with Gerstein Agnew and a senior advisor to Democracy Corps. But in terms of calling the bluff on this this extortion that's going on by the Republicans and apparently by the Tea Party wing, because it's not even clear that Boehner's bill is going to pass. It looks like the Tea Party are going to scuttle it. But if the president were to call their bluff, the problem there is that it would be a Pyrrhic victory, surely, as the other the fellow that was running for president there for a while, Donald Trump, said on Fox News, rather gleefully, I'm afraid, he said, oh, well, you know, he wants to destroy Obama's presidency. And he said that, you know, go ahead, bring the House down. The Republicans will get blamed for it in the short term, but by election time, Obama will be left with the wreckage and he'll go down.
As we started this conversation, it's kind of the framework that's been accepted in this debate, but there's a lot of other possibilities that are out here. You know, former President Clinton has advocated the fact that the president should rely upon the 14th Amendment and his responsibility here to ensure the full faith and credit of the United States and basically ignore what Congress is doing right now. A fact that I'm struck at how little is discussed is the fact that this Congress passed a budget. Right? Remember the long debate that we had over it, the full fight that was had over the budget. They passed a budget. They are now refusing to fund the budget that they passed. It's almost like constitutional double jeopardy here, that they're going back and relitigating legislation that they've already passed by refusing to fund a budget that they have already gone ahead and passed. So, you know, the president does have those options.
So, but Carl Agnew, surely, I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer like the president, but if he goes ahead and uses that provision in the 14th Amendment that it goes back to obviously the post-Civil War era, it becomes law, I guess, and then it's challenged, right?
Absolutely. And you know, and I think that we're looking at a series of very unfavorable circumstances here. But if the choices are to stop paying Social Security, to stop paying soldiers in the field, to stop paying veterans, or to use, you know, his responsibilities as president to face up to the responsibilities and to do right by this country, I think it's a choice that can be made, and it's a fight that we should be willing to have.
And how quickly do you think it will get to the Supreme Court? Because the Supreme Court is fairly conservative, as you're well aware.
Absolutely. And, you know, and again, we're in uncharted waters at that point. I don't have the legal expertise to tell you that. But I also think that it sends a powerful message for this president and those who agree with his position in this fight.
So as a strategist then, Carl Agnew, you don't feel we're in a worse situation. I mean, the analogy, when Carville made those remarks, it felt to me like a de facto way of saying that under Clinton, when they had a similar situation, they strategized in a way that ended up with Clinton coming out on top and Gingrich basically going too far. You can't equate that, can you? Because it's one thing to shut down the government temporarily; it's another thing to destroy the economy.
It is. It absolutely is. The stakes are higher here, but in that fight, they did position the president well, and they did dare the Republicans to take the ultimate step, which in that one was shutting down the government, and the Republicans chose to take the ultimate step rather than compromise and reach an agreement. We're in the same position here, only the stakes are higher.
But you have a different president in the sense that this president is a conciliator. He's reached out to them. I think he genuinely believes in bipartisanship. And I spoke to people that put on seminars at Harvard that he attended, you know, these long weekend seminars where Ralph Reed would sit down with Andy Stern or somebody, you know, that kind of mixture. And he said the president really really enjoys that kind of give and take. So it seems like he's already committed himself to the path that he's on. I don't think he's going to pull that kind of ultimatum, is he?
It's certainly not his natural position. I certainly don't think it's the path that he wants to take. But as we get closer and closer to August 2nd, everyone faces a dwindling set of options that are increasingly unpleasant.
I see. Well, do you think then that his strategy, if indeed it is his strategy, and that's what you mentioned earlier, the press keep referring to being the adult in the room, that he is going to win over the center, and that I don't know what the polling suggests here, but I've already asked you the question whether winning over the center it will mean that you lose the left, and a lot of people argue that the worst thing that could happen is that the Republicans suddenly wake up and behave with some sanity and accept these deals that we told were being offered, And if that were true, a lot of the sort of legacy of the New Deal would be up for grab. At least that's what we were told about what's been going on. We don't know the exact details, but do you accept that notion that maybe it's better that the stuff that was on the table was rejected and is now off the table?
It's very difficult to know what's really on and off the table. You know, members of Congress with whom I've spoken really don't know. You know, I think anyone who isn't in the room as these multiple levels of negotiations are going on, they'll really know exactly what's on and off the table. So it's difficult to speculate. But certainly a lot of what we've seen in the press is disheartening in terms of the imbalance that's being discussed. And we have to see how permanent this deal is as well. You know, what ultimately gets decided, whether it's large, whether it's small, whatever it is going to, I think, be relitigated in the 2012 elections.
And given the nature of the way that the president ultimately laid out his argument, which essentially I think came down to the notion, and I think it's a pretty clear fact that the Republicans are extorting this kind of situation in order to get everything they want, largely at the behest of millionaires and billionaires, and to whom they are being thoroughly faithful. And the president went on to point out that, you know, hedge fund managers proportionally pay less tax than their secretaries. It's time for the people who've done so well over the last few decades to pony up. And you only have to go back to the Clinton era to see that when everybody paid their fair share of taxes, instead of the economy crashing, it boomed.
Absolutely. And I mean, go back to the discussions that were being had a month ago that, again, have been completely obscured here. But what is it that the Democrats were asking for? They were not asking for tax increases on people who make $50,000 a year. They were asking to close the loopholes for oil companies and corporate jet deductions. I mean, these are not outrageous requests. These are not, you know, really galling ones and ones that put a disproportionate burden on Americans across the board. It would hurt the economy in any real way. Of course, Republicans reflexively say that this would hurt mom-and-pop businesses. That, you know, it doesn't matter what tax you discuss. That's their automatic response no matter what. But the taxes that we were talking about, the balance that was trying to be introduced into the deal, is really striking in how modest the efforts were.
Well, but I guess just in closing then, Carl Agnew, I'd like to get a sense of from polling where we stand in this country in terms of whether we have become sort of vicarious, like in the 1930s, during the Depression, they made all those movies about rich people, you know, whether we're all sort of, you know, have this aspirational politics where one day we'll win the lottery and we'll become millionaires and billionaires, just like Donald Trump, although I think he's a phony in that regard as well. But the long and the short of it is there still a sense of fairness? Is there some outrage over there? Out there about the growing disparity in wealth in this country, the idea that the middle class and the working people in this country are bearing the brunt, that the wealthy are having an enormous free ride. Is there still a sense of an American meritocracy?
Above all, what this debate has reinforced is how broken Washington is and how no one in Washington is really looking out for what's best for this country. But when I go out and talk to voters all over the country, what strikes me more than anything else, the complaint that I hear in the exact same words, in the exact same sentiments, in the exact same outrage, no matter where I am in the country, is the growing gap between the wealthy and everyone else, the destruction of the American middle class, and the loss of the great American middle class that they believe built this country, particularly in the post-World War II period, when we became the economic superpower in the world. It was built on the great American middle class, which in turn was built upon education and innovation and investment and manufacturing jobs and all the things that have been lost, which have in turn created this great imbalance. And you hear that exact same story no matter if you go to Michigan and Ohio or if you go to California or if you go to Florida, you go anywhere in the country and talk, and you hear that same story from voters. There's absolutely no doubt. And the outrage and the frustration just keeps growing and growing, and there seems to be no outlet for them.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carl Agnew.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Agnew, who is the founding partner with Gerstein Agnew. He's conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns, including directing national research and message development for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He also serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped found in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Shrum. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about the president's and John Boehner's speeches, which the press afforded equal time, equal attention, even though one side is threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of what they want. I talked to this editor from the New Republic, Jonathan Cohn, who gave, I thought, a very good sort of centrist analysis of what's happening in Washington and how the chips might fall. And he had written, the reason I talked to him, he'd written about who's really responsible for the deficit and the debt. And of course, surprise, surprise, it's the Republicans, particularly George W. Bush. And then I sort of suggested, well, how come, does it matter anymore? Does anybody pay attention to the facts in this country anymore? And it really it is a situation that leads you to despair. I thought he gave a very good analysis, nevertheless, of what's going on. Then we talked to a presidential historian who studies both the American right and the presidency. Obviously, given that the Tea Party are the ones that are forcing Boehner or whipsawing him every time he makes a deal, they come and scream at him, and they actually may scuttle his bill, which means that Obama won't even have to veto it. But Alan Lichtman really actually, he kind of caught on fire, I thought, and really finds this whole obscenity of the Tea Party, the idea that they are trying to hijack the American Constitution and the notion of patriotism and going back to the Founding Fathers and the Boston Tea Party, when in fact they are such absolutely faithful whores to the billionaires. They are all of them have hired lobbyists as their congressional staffers, and they are voting in lockstep to defend and protect the rights of the billionaires in this country. And it should be obvious. I just don't know that it is. I asked that of our third guest, Carl Agnew, who's a campaign strategist, because a lot of people from the Clinton administration, like James Carville and others, who were very successful in their strategy in terms of a similar situation when during the Clinton administration, Newt Gingrich threatened to shut down the government, which he did. Well, that really backfired. Of course, the situation today is far more grave, and it's not likely to work out well for Clinton, for Obama, in as much as if he could get stuck with the blame a year later if the economy is destroyed, which it would be. If these reckless fools had their way. He actually, the strategist, seemed to think that what Clinton would, I mean, what Obama would do would go to the constitutional route, the 14th Amendment, and suddenly invoke that. So stay tuned. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.